It was less than a week ago that we got the grim news about Western monarch butterflies in last fall's Thanksgiving count. The 2018 number was more than 99% below the highest number in the count, raising concerns that there are just not enough Western monarchs left to continue the population. That's just one insect on one continent. There are plenty of other concerns about insects around the world. And we'll spend this hour exploring those with people who know and care about insects. We have right now Christina Lefevre, who's with the Pollinator Project Rogue Valley. Lynn, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Alan Journay is with us as well. He's a retired ecologist and conservation biologist. He studied entomology in Canada and conducted his postdoctoral studies in Australia before teaching biology at Southeast Missouri State University. And, of course, now he's with Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. Alan Journay, good to see you.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here again. Appreciate it.
We expect to have Lynn Kimsey on the phone in a couple of minutes as well, joining us from the University of California, Davis. We're trying to establish contact right now. And we'll get her on in just a few moments. But let's start with the folks in the studio and give us a sense of where you see things. Alan, you're the scientist in the group so far. Talk about where things stand from the perspective of someone who just looks at the data and the numbers.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head when you started talking about monarchs. And we are seeing across the board a really serious depletion in insect populations. And one of the things that folks have a tendency to do is think about insects as being a pain. And we have to acknowledge that without insects, we'd be in really deep doo-doo. There are more insects on the planet than any other group of organisms.
They outweigh human beings, I
say, well,
right?
J.B.S. Haldane, many, many years ago, who is a student of beetles, was asked one day, so what Dr. Haldane, has your study of beetles taught you about the universe and God? And he said, well, I don't know, not very much, except God must have had an inordinate fondness for beetles because there are so many beetles on the planet. So we know that there are many insects out there. Many of them are extremely important to us because of their role in pollination, and hence Christina's concern about them. And we know that the populations of many species of insects are really on a steep decline. You mentioned the monarchs, but they're not alone. And this is one of the issues that got Christina really interested in. This is why she came to us at SOCAN and said, how about a program on insects? And so with my background in entomology, I says to myself, well, there's an interesting subject.
Uh-huh. So that you'll take this up at a SOCAN meeting on the 26th, is that right?
Yes, a week from yesterday, I guess, Tuesday.
Right. So Lynn, Christina, let me get some perspective from you then, because as you point out, you're not a scientist. Your degree is in business from Georgia State University. Yeah. But what got you so interested in the Pollinator Project and the work involved in trying to help bring insect populations back?
Well, I'm like everybody else. I eat. And so people need to realize that, you know, we are dependent on these insects. The pollinators specifically is what we've been focusing on. The native bees, the honeybees, flies. There are hoverflies that actually provide a lot of pollination as well. So people need to understand that, but that's just one subset of all the insects. Alan mentioned how many, there's like a million species of insects and like 5,700 species of mammals. I picked that up in my reading. So it's just mind-boggling to think how many species, and then that's not even including the number of individuals. So as I began learning more about pollinators, I realized how important they are, and you can just look around, even in the valley, and you can see how things are changing, and there isn't a place for these creatures to live in many places now. And then more and more studies have come out about the horrible decline, and then I read the article, the study about it's called the insect apocalypse, the study that happened in Puerto Rico, comparing 40 years difference in populations, and it was just devastating to realize that is almost a precursor to what could happen on this planet right there in Puerto Rico. So it's just over years that I've become more and more interested in the situation with pollinators and insects.
Let's bring in our phone guest now. Lynn Kimsey is an entomologist, taxonomist, director of the Bohart Museum of Entomology and professor of entomology at the University of California, Davis. Since 1989, her specialties are bees and wasps and insect diversity. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Kimsey.
Well, thank you very much.
So let's start with insect diversity. I mean, has it gotten to be a troubling issue? I can imagine it has.
Where to start? See, the problem is we don't know anything. And I mean that in a very realistic sense. Let me sort of outline why I say that. We did a survey in a set of sand dunes in Southern California. That was 200 square miles of sand. We found 2,000 plus species of insects. We did, at the same time, a survey on a mountaintop in Indonesia, in Sulawesi. A rough estimate, 100,000 species of insects in 200 square miles of rainforest. 50% were new to science. Okay, that's 50,000 insects in one place.
Uh-huh.
We really don't know anything.
You just have no idea of the overall amount
no.
of them.
No, and the problem with these studies is that they're very limited in scope. The one in was it Denmark, I think, basically compared sampling sites all over the country as opposed to, you know, consistent sampling over a long period in one or two or three places. So the data, it's really difficult to extrapolate. I think it may be real, but because we don't have any baseline for 99% of the globe, it's really hard to say.
Okay, we'll pick it up there on the other side of a break. I definitely want to explore this pathway a little further. We're talking about insects and their fate on the planet with Lynn Kimsey from UC Davis, Christina Lefevre from the Pollinator Project Rogue Valley, and Alan Journay, a retired biologist. You can join the conversation on the exchange by phone and email when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about insects in trouble. By quite a few reports, it does appear that we are losing large numbers of insects on the planet. But, well, we have some ground to cover in this, both in discussing how we know that and in what we do about the information. Our guests are Lynn Kimsey, an entomologist at the University of California, Davis, joining us by phone. In the studio, we have Alan Journay, a retired biologist and now one of the co-coordinators of SOCAN, Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. Christina Lefevre is with us as well from Pollinator Project Rogue Valley. And you can join the conversation on the exchange. Your thoughts, questions, comments about insects and their lack around the globe, or if you're happy about that, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Lynn Kimsey, I want to give you a chance to finish the thought, because you're saying that just the sheer numbers of insect species on the planet, particularly in remote places, make it hard for us to know what the baseline is.
Yeah, we really don't have baseline information for most places. In California, for example, we have probably baseline information for one place up in the Sierra where a course has been taught every year for the past 40 years. But that's only for 6 weeks out of the year. So we just don't have consistent sampling. The data probably exists in insect collections. The problem is that most of those now are so underfunded that you just don't get access to it. We do not fund research on insects very well.
Why is that?
I don't know. You know, it recently came out that all the biology textbooks being produced in the country now don't even mention insects, and yet it's the most diverse group of animals on Earth. I can't answer it. I don't understand it.
I think that would be probably outside of the pests, which do get their share of research,
but not much anymore. The basic
diversity is of apparently little interest to the funding agencies.
Yeah, not at all.
Well, let's talk about that part of it, Alan Jornet, then, because when you hear people refer to insects as pests, I mean, they're not trying to be pests. They're trying to live their life, but of course it interferes with other people's life processes.
Mm-hmm. And they are incredibly critical to ecosystems, of course. There are many, many species, particularly of birds, that everybody is familiar with, who are birds that are insectivores. And so when we are potentially losing insects, we are disrupting the entire ecological chain of events, the entire web, and compromising the insectivores.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there are too many people, it sounds like, who still think in terms of, this is the range of animals we're generally going to reach for either a swatter or a can of spray first, aren't we?
Well,
of course, those are the things that will dispatch them. You don't want to use a swatter and a can of spray on a rat, for example.
Yeah, but then we have to think about, is that really a good insect or not? And I think there are some that aren't. The mosquitoes, obviously, and with climate change, they're moving in different areas. But people also don't always identify them. So they might think it's a wasp and it's actually a bee. So one of the things that Pollinator Project Rogue Valley talks about is helping people understand the beneficial insects that are out there. There's a lot of people, they don't even know what a fly looks like, one of the pollinating flies. They don't even necessarily know what a bee looks like. So the education is important, and for people to understand that so many of them are actually beneficial. There's even talk about some of the insects that we think are pests, like a thrip. It can actually be a pollinating insect as well for some flowers. So insects have a diverse role, and we consider some of them pests because they interfere with our lifestyle. But
so for you coming at this, Christina, with a non-science background,
right.
I mean, have you really had your eyes open to the wide range of pollinators?
Oh yeah, there's a lot of pollinating insects. Native bees, people don't think about them as much. People think when they hear the word pollinator, they think honeybee. And we need native bees as well for our food crops, as well as our native plants around us. We have a lot of plants on the hillsides because they get pollinated, the madrones and the manzanitas and the shooting stars. And then there's bumblebees, all sorts of variety of bees. Oregon has over 500 species of native bees, and people don't realize that. Then I mentioned pollinating flies. There's hoverflies, tachinid flies, beetles. There's some beetles that are pollinators. Then we also have moths and butterflies. They don't really feed us so much, but they're important. And then we also have the hummingbirds. So the pollinators are in a very important subset, and people think, if they see a nest in the ground that they think is a wasp, because, of course, all wasps live in the ground, which is not necessarily a true statement, but people think that. But 70% of the bees are ground nesters. So just because you see, quote, wasps in the ground, they could be bees. So there's a lot of education. So they are not necessarily a pest. In fact, I would say that pollinators are not pests.
So Lynn Kimsey, with one of your specialty areas being bees and wasps, I mean, it sounds like this has probably been a major part of your career is identifying to people which ones help people and which ones will just sting them and cause problems for them.
Right. Yeah, no, my students started a collection of media outputs and advertisements of what we call wannabes. And these are images of, generally speaking, flies that are labeled as honeybees.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we have a long way to go.
So give us a sense, though, because all the great concerns about bees and colony collapse disorder and the other things that have befallen bees, bee populations in recent years. I mean, I get the total overall point with insects is that we just don't know what the baseline is. But, I mean, these are demonstrable drops in population and populations that we do know something about, aren't they?
Yeah, for some of these, well, but all the reasons seem to be a bit different for each of these. For example, with bumblebees, now there's a site in Brookings, Oregon, where I've sampled for years. When I first started going there, there were 6 species of bumblebees. There's now 1. So that's a marked change.
Mm-hmm.
But what seems to be going on there is the use of European bumblebee as a pollinator in greenhouses, mm-hmm. for tomatoes and things like this, that there's a pathogen that the European bumblebee is immune to, but it carries, and we have this very closely related bumblebees in that, you know, the northwestern coast region, and they're susceptible. So there is a thought, not demonstrated, that in fact it's a pathogen that was brought in by our use of these exotic bees. You know, so that's one issue. The other issue is, if you really want to effectively extirpate ground nesting bees and wasps, the best way to do it is to cover the soil with chipwood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's being done everywhere now, as you know, it's a way to hold down weeds and to keep moisture in the soil. But you cover that bare soil up, especially in sunny areas, and you've exterminated the wasps and bees that nest in the ground.
So it's not necessarily deliberate, but just something that provides for ease of landscaping care.
And that does keep the soil moisture in. So it's one of those double-edged swords, mm-hmm. I guess, where we're doing something
you're
positive.
You're damned if you do and damned mm-hmm. if you don't, I think is the way it comes out. But, you know, without understanding the natural history of these insects, how would you know?
It's a really good point, Lynn, because that is something, even I have to work on that, because I believe mulch is great, but then, you know, what have I just done in my
You've
own
done bad
landscape?
Things.
Exactly. So we do talk about that. Exactly.
Yeah, it's tough, and we just need much better education, I think, is a big part of this.
And you were talking about the bumblebee and the pathogen, because we think, not me, but other people think that that's what has caused the demise of our Franklin bumblebee here, which is a native and has not been seen since, 2006? So it's, you know, these pathogens and things moving around are definitely affecting species.
So there are a lot of different things that are causing the problems. You know, ironically, one of the other things, which is something we don't think about, this is all of this comes under unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. But it's perfectly acceptable to put honeybees or, you know, expose other bees to fungicides that they treat fields with, you know,
and
onions and things like this. But what people don't realize is that you can't make a new baby bee from pollen and nectar. It's not possible. It's missing too many micronutrients, vitamins, things like this. What bees are doing is they truly are making what we call bee bread, and that is when they take nectar and pollen back to the colony or to their nest. They mix it up with yeasts that are on their bodies and yeasts that are in the environment, and the yeasts actually create a fermentation product that has these micronutrients. Now, you expose bees to fungicides, doesn't hurt the adult bees, but they take it back to their nest, and you end up with malnourished babies.
Wow. So it really gets down to a very small level of what the effects
It can be, and just things you just don't think about. You know, so you've got the sort of the microbiome in bees, you've got nesting areas, you have insecticide exposures, you have changing in landscaping. Let's face it, we all like to put in exotic plants in our yards. Well, that's not going to help the native pollinators at all. And so, you know, lawns, all these things that we do without even thinking are fairly deleterious.
Let me remind our listeners, we're talking about insects in trouble around the world with Lynn Kimsey, an entomologist at the University of California, Davis, Christina Lefevre from the Pollinator Project, Rogue Valley, and Alan Journay, a retired biologist now with SOCAN, Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. SOCAN is hosting a session called Bugged by Global Warming, Insects in a Changing Climate, next Tuesday evening at 6 at the Medford Library?
At Medford Public Library, yeah.
All right, and you can join the conversation now on the Jefferson Exchange. Got a couple calls waiting at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let us take one of these calls. Let's go first to Karen in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, I just heard this morning on the news program about they're doing a genetically altered mosquito that is, it sounded really bizarre, and they want to release them in Africa to decrease malaria. and they're going on and on about how secure it is and that they are sterile and they can't reproduce. And I don't know, it sounds just like Jurassic Park. And plus,
right,
what about and all the animals that rely on mosquitoes for food? I just wondered if you looked at that kind of an impact.
All right, let's take that up. Thanks for the call, Karen. And yes, I heard the same piece on Morning Edition just as I was pulling up to work, and the idea being that there's a lab in Italy that they're very careful to make sure the mosquitoes do not get out into the world, and they wouldn't be able to survive in Italy anyway, but they've been gene-edited with CRISPR so that they will not be able to reproduce, the idea being that they'll decrease the populations of malaria-bearing insects flying around in tropical parts of the world. Let's get some thoughts from you, Alan Jornet, about that kind of manipulation and whether it's proper in the broader environment.
Well, we're all concerned, I think, or many of us are concerned about the whole idea of genetic manipulation, but this is a technique that has been used for some time in the arena of sort of biological control, a mechanism for controlling insects without spraying them with pesticides. And it's one of those ideas that intrinsically sounds promising if we can get the sterile mosquitoes out there mating with the wild population, then they don't make babies, so we reduce the mosquito population without spraying. And that sounds very, very promising, but of course it does have ecosystem consequences. Of course, we don't like malaria, but the point was made earlier that mosquitoes are food for other organisms, and so we are disrupting the food web. Everything has consequences.
Indeed it does. Lynn Kimsey, what do you think about those trials?
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about it. You know, okay, I'm a diehard cynic, and I believe that Murphy rules the universe, which states that if anything can go wrong, it will go wrong. And I just worry that you could have some serious unintended consequences, but also it kind of overlooks the way things evolve. And I suspect that it would not be sustainable if it even did work, that you'd have to continually be putting out more and more of these modified mosquitoes to try to swamp the population. I like the sterile male releases that they've done for years.
Yeah, of course, if you have sterile males, they're not going to make more sterile males. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Indeed. Let's take another call. Here is Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about insects with Lynn Kimsey, Alan Jornet, and Christina Lefevre.
You know, one thing that sobered me up about living on planet Earth in relationship to other life is the Ant-Man from Harvard. I don't remember his name now.
Ed Wilson. E.O. Wilson.
Yeah, E.O. Wilson. Said that if you take all of the population of people on this planet as a biomass, a weight, and you do the same thing with ants, you pretty much come up with the same number. So that's just one group of insects on this planet. And so knowing what I just said, much more careful about the way that I live on this planet. And if you have any comments, I'm listening.
All right. Thanks for that, Carter.
Thank Christina? You for that. Mm-hmm. I think it's good that we think of ourselves as part of the ecosystem instead of above it, and thinking of how we can live with all the various creatures. In fact, that is something that I think as people, as we become more aware, I think that is happening. There have been so many studies talking about the horrible declines of insects in different places. I mentioned the one that was a 40-year study in Puerto Rico, and then there was the one in Germany over 27 years. It was just, you know, quote, amateur biologists, but they did have the records. So there's all these studies, but then there was another study that came out, or another report that came out of a woman who is saying that if we are able to just change our practices to account for these other creatures that live on the planet, that we can actually do a turnaround. And I think that especially here in Southern Oregon, I think that is happening. People here are concerned about their environment and how we protect it. We have so many organizations here in the Valley, KS Wild, SOCAN, obviously, so many others that are doing great things to educate and protect. And if we can start changing how we live in our own little space, you know, not mulching in areas that we think we should mulch, or putting in green roofs, or putting in bioswales to collect water, and just thinking of ways that these creatures live with us and we can live with them, I think we can do something. And so what you're doing is just raising that education for people to think of the ants that way and humans in that way.
Just before we go to a break, I want to get an email in here from Bill in Arcata, who writes, "Haldane's comments about insects parallels Lincoln's comment on the common man. We too often value things for their contribution to our own concerns, mm-hmm. the value of tropical plants for possible medicinal content, for example. Insects don't just help us pollinate our crops and bother us by biting us. They are the stitching that holds the living world together. Mm-hmm. They aren't just beneficial or harmful. Even mosquitoes," writes Bill in Arcata. And that is echoed by Phyllis in Grants Pass, who writes that people are forgetting that insects are a major food source for other animals. Mm-hmm. We'll pick that up on the other side of a break and get some more comments from our panel here. We're talking to Alan Jornet, Christina Lefevre, and Lynn Kimsey about the fate of insects in the world. Short break, back on the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about insects and our relationship with insects, because we like to swat them, we like to spray them, we like to do things to get rid of them. But the fact is that they are part of life on the planet. And as we've already learned, we're not even sure how much life on the planet they represent, because we're still learning of new species all the time. Our guests are Lynn Kimsey, an entomologist at the University of California, Davis, Christina Lefevre from the Pollinator Project Rogue Valley, Alan Jornet, who's a retired biologist now with SOCAN, Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. SOCAN is holding a session next Tuesday evening at the Medford Library called "Bugged by Global Warming, Insects in a Changing Climate." You can join the conversation here now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And Alan, you wanted to weigh in on the comments we got just before the break about people saying, hey, look, you know, we're part of the ecosystem, and so are they.
Yes, I spent years teaching conservation biology, and one of the underlying ethical components of teaching that course is trying to explain to students how we need to have a biocentric worldview, not just an anthropocentric worldview, which was what one of the callers was alluding to a moment ago. We do have a tendency to think of the world in terms of what good it is to us. Mm-hmm. But the biocentric worldview goes a little further than that and asks, what is it that we need to do in order to maintain the biodiversity of the planet, not for our sakes, but for its own sake, just because it has intrinsic value. And that's something that we need to understand as we think about what's the most convenient thing we can do to cure malaria and so on and so forth. It gets very complicated, as Lynn was saying. It tends to lead one to a somewhat cynical kind of a approach.
Well, it's not about about what it can do for us, but what we can do for the system.
Well, I like that. Yeah, it's an ask not what biodiversity can do for you, but what you can do for biodiversity.
I love that. That's perfect.
Lynn Kimsey, to the specific point that was raised by one of our other callers, Phyllis in Grants Pass, was pointing out that mosquitoes are a food source for lots of creatures. I mean, so if you take one creature like that out of the ecosystem or reduce it greatly, you're going to have reductions in other species that you didn't intend to reduce, right?
Yeah, and largely vertebrates. So mosquitoes, we only think about the adults, but the mm-hmm. larvae are critical food for things like fish. There's some birds that eat them.
Dragonflies.
Yeah, and so Yeah, it's all very interconnected. One thing that people need to realize, though, is that there are some groups of insects that are doing fabulously well now because they are adapted to the kind of unstable habitats that humans automatically create.
Uh-huh.
So think about cockroaches, think about houseflies, think about crickets. I mean, some of these groups, I'm seeing populations, and they're moving around because we move them around. I'm seeing population growth in some of these that is pretty spectacular. But this isn't something we focus on. We focus on wildlands and what's happening there. And yet, so again, it's very complicated. But some insect species are doing very well.
So, this brings up a question that came in an email from Cheryl in Lane County, who says, I would think that insects could mutate rapidly to change with their circumstances. Is that often the case, you find, Lynn?
No. In fact, it's kind of ironic. But insects tend to change, new species form or, very dramatic changes take place in insects over tens of or hundreds of thousands of years. They're much, much slower to change than mice, for example. I mean, rodents probably change it far faster than insects. There was a study done in Hawaii where they were looking at Drosophila species, and they could date the formation of new species based on lava flows on some of the islands, minimum of 40,000 years.
Wow, that's a long period.
So we tend to think of insects as changing rapidly, but they really don't.
Let me come back to square one, because this was part of the conversation that occurred before we got you on the line here.
Uh-huh.
And I just wondered what you thought generally about the concept of insect apocalypse. I mean, are we going to crash right now generally, or are you a little more cautious about using those kinds of terms?
I would be cautious simply because I don't think the data's there. Now, we're seeing dramatic changes in certain places. Maybe that does extrapolate to everywhere, but I'm just not entirely convinced at this point.
All right, let's take a call here from Francis in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange as we continue our discussion on insects.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I've been a federal scientist for 35 years and came to Mount Shasta in 81. The first thing I did was start to take aquatic insect samples and terrestrial insect samples, and of course, as a biologist for the Forest Service, I was doing a lot looking at the birds too, and took data and samples there as well. And here in the Mount Shasta area, you'd think of pure and pristine. Well, the insects are down to about 20% normal levels or less, especially the bees. And the birds are down to about 10% of normal population. My question for the panel is, while global warming is undoubtedly a factor in it, I'm wondering, I've also been measuring a lot of air samples, precipitation samples, having them chemically analyzed at the EPA labs, and I'm getting a lot of aluminum, barium, strontium, just lately, sulfur from the jet spraying for climate change control. And I wonder if they...
Okay, we're going to stop there. I don't have any evidence that that happens. Does anybody at this table or on this conversation
have evidence? My comment is I have spent a considerable amount of time researching the claim of chemtrails, and every evidence that I have seen is a hoax, a fraud. So I just don't buy that argument in any sense.
Then let's see if we can assign some responsibility here in the places that are seeing reductions. I mean, how much do we think is pesticides? How much do we think is habitat loss? How much do we think is climate change? And is it even possible to pull those apart, Christina?
Well, I was reading last night this long article, and Lynn, I would like to have some of your comments on this. This just came out January 2019, and there was a review by a panel of scientists that they took 73 historical reports of insect declines from across the globe and systematically assess the underlying drivers. That's what I'm reading from that. And without boring you, reading the 22 pages of this report in very small type, I have to have my reading glasses on. The conclusion, the first paragraph of the conclusion says, this review highlights the dreadful state of insect biodiversity in the world, as almost half of the species are rapidly declining and a third are being threatened with extinction. And in this report, they go through the major reasons, and climate change is the latter part. They mention agriculture and the pesticides that are used in that. They mention development. They mention deletion of removal of natural habitats like hedgerows. So there's a list of things that are here, urbanization. So they do mention climate change. And this is a worldwide study, and they're using the word dreadful. My eyebrow went up when I read that because that's pretty dreadful. So it seems that there's reports out there, and it's a combination, because if you think about the things that are causing the decline of insects, they are also contributing to climate change. So everything is connected. So if you have a big urbanization and you have a lot of pervious surfaces of concrete, then that's helping cause the heat island in the city, which is helping raise the temperature, which is helping to make it more hard for an insect to live. So it's all connected.
Alan, thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I think Christina hit the nail on the head. It's probably going to be very difficult for us to tease out a major cause. I think global warming, climate change is probably a substantial cause, because when you look at insect physiology, you can see that thermoregulation is one of the issues that they have. Although as the temperature warms, that tends to promote insect growth and increase insect populations and cause problems for vector-borne diseases. But the insects also have, at the other end of the extreme, a problem with water balance. And as we dry out, insects have problems with maintaining their internal hydration. So I'm guessing that global warming, climate change is substantially impacting these mm-hmm. insects. And one of the other things that's happening beside, as a consequence of that, was we're getting range shifts up in elevation further north, which becomes a vector-borne disease problem for us. And we're seeing for herbivorous insects, we're seeing food shifts and so forth. So there are a lot of problems out there for insects that are a consequence of global warming and the climate change consequences.
Now, so your field work, I understand, was in Central America?
I did some field work in Central America, but that was on small mammals. That was during my recovery phase.
Recovering from entomology.
I was recovering from entomology, but when I was in Australia,
bad man.
You see, when I say that to entomologists, they don't find it quite so funny. But when I was in Australia, I was working on nutritional components of how nutrition was influencing insects. And one of the odd factors is, for herbivorous insects, a major problem for them is getting enough nitrogen. And when tree species are droughted, their response in many cases is to increase the free amino acid composition of the tissues, which makes the trees actually more nutritious to the insects, which is one of the positive feedback loops that's probably influencing bark beetles and increasing their damage.
Okay, that makes sense. I want to ask Lynn Kimsey this, because you're not just teaching entomology and studying it, but also are you still the director of the Bohart Museum of Entomology?
All right.
So there's a thing you're going to teach to students who are learning the finer points of entomology, and then things you're going to push out to the public as the director of the museum. And I just wonder what the general message is to the general public now about insects and their fate on the planet.
I think we're keeping it more basic than that. In fact, there's a group of about 20 third graders out in front of my office right now. We try to simply educate them about insects. You know, one of the things that I find is that you not only have to do some very basic education about insects, you know, what's a fly, what's a honeybee. But when I take students out in the field, I also have to teach them to see the insects because they don't see them. Most insects are very small, and we are kind of hardwired to see the big flashy things like butterflies and big beetles.
The charismatic megafauna.
Exactly. But that's really a tiny, tiny percentage of the insects. And so just educating people about, you know, what to fear, what not to fear, that's very, very important in my view, because fear drive is driven by ignorance, and you can get a lot of crazy things happening because people are fearful. You know, so that's kind of where we aim at this point.
Does the museum still loan out insects?
Yeah, sure. We loan specimens to scientists. We have exhibits and educational specimens that we loan to teachers and local groups, and we do a lot of that. We probably service everybody within a 100, 200-mile radius.
Well, so that's a good chance for people to get to know insects a little better under slightly more controlled circumstances.
Yeah, and we also have a petting zoo. I'll just let your imaginations work with that. But it's fun because, I mean, you can working with, say, these third graders, you can see them light up when they understand that, you know, insects are cool. They're not terrifying, you know, monsters with fangs, dripping blood, and venom and things. And that's very powerful, I think.
Oh, yes. They're not all here to suck your blood.
That's right.
Christina Lefevre, as a non-scientist, you gave a great list of things to do before, and I just want to get some closing thoughts from you about just general thinking about insects.
And what we can do?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for asking, because everyone can participate in saving the insects, which saves other fauna, mega and otherwise. The best thing really to do is plant gardens, plant pollinator landscapes. Lynn mentioned the exotic plants. Stick with your native, stick with your pollinator plants as much as possible. Visit your nurseries that don't use neonicotinoids. Take a class from master gardeners, learn about them, think about your ecosystem around you in a different way.
Don't mulch.
Right.
Think about how it would be if a bee lived there instead of you.
All right. Christina Lefevre, Pollinator Project, Rogue Valley. Lynn Kimsey, UC Davis entomologist. Alan Journay, retired biologist now with SOCAN. Thank you all for joining us.